So this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 79 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. So check it out at CertFuel.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I want to start by setting a scene. Just imagine you are the CEO of a billion-dollar tech startup.
Right.
You go on a popular podcast. You know, you have a few laughs. You talk about how explosive your user growth has been this quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And you head home.
Sounds like a good day.
Right. But the next morning, you wake up to find that the SEC has completely frozen your upcoming IPO, and they're threatening you with federal securities violations.
Oh, yeah.
And you're thinking, why? Because the high-stakes world of federal securities law, simply opening your mouth and talking can literally be a federal crime.
It's a terrifying realization for a lot of executives. We're so used to the idea that marketing is just a normal part of doing business. You hype your product, you hype your vision. But I mean, the moment you decide to access the public capital markets, that entire instinct becomes a massive liability.
And that is exactly what we are mapping out today. We're taking the entire life cycle of a registered public offering and sort of, you know, hacking our way through the dense regulatory jungle of the SEC and FINRA.
Yeah, which is dense.
Very dense. But we aren't just going to list off a bunch of rules and filing deadlines because, I mean, for me and for anyone with ADHD studying for the Series 79 exam, if you just brute force memorize these prohibitions, it will all evaporate from your brain the second you sit down at the testing center.
Oh, totally.
We're going to break down the underlying mechanics. Want to know the why behind the rules.
Because the SEC and FINRA didn't just, you know, invent these rules to torture investment bankers.
Although it feels like it sometimes.
It does. It really does. But every single regulation, every obscure filing deadline, it's a mechanical solution to a historical problem. When you understand the problem they were trying to solve, the rule itself becomes entirely logical. You don't have to memorize it. You just deduce it.
Right. So to keep this completely grounded, we are going to rely on a recurring cast of characters today to anchor all these crazy scenarios.
Yeah.
So meet our three players.
Okay.
First, we have Frank, the founder. Frank is this chaotic, highly caffeinated CEO of Frank's Ferrets, which is a fast-growing pet tech startup.
Frank's Ferrets. I love it.
Yeah. They make an AI collar that supposedly translates ferret squeaks into English.
Incredible.
It's huge. Frank is a visionary. And he is desperately trying to take his company public.
Which means Frank is a walking compliance violation waiting to happen. I mean, the regulators see a guy like Frank and immediately start drafting subpoenas.
Exactly. He's the ultimate wild card. So next we have underwriter Uma. She is the stressed out investment banker at a major syndicate desk. She's surviving on like triple espressos. And her entire job is to shepherd this IPO while desperately trying to keep Frank out of SEC jail.
Poor Uma.
I know, right? And finally, we have buyer Bob. Bob is an institutional hedge fund manager. He wears a lot of fleece vests, you know, hangs out at expensive hotel bars on Sand Hill Road, and is constantly probing Frank for inside information.
So we've got the risk taker, the risk manager, and the opportunist. It is the perfect ecosystem to explain securities law.
Yeah. So let's jump into the timeline. Because before Frank can sell a single share of Frank's Ferrets to the public, Uma sits him down and explains the overarching structure of an initial public offering. The core framework comes from the Securities Act of 1933.
The 33 Act, yeah.
And the best way to visualize the 1933 Act is as a heavily regulated foot race.
I rely on that foot race analogy all the time, honestly, because it perfectly partitions the timeline. The 1933 Act splits every single public offering into three distinct periods. And if you know where you are on the track, you'll always know exactly what you are legally allowed to do.
Right. So in this race, there are two major milestones. The starter pistol firing is the moment Uma files the registration statement with the SEC. That's milestone one.
Right.
And the finish line is the moment the SEC declares that registration statement effective. Everything revolves around the pistol and the finish line.
Which puts us at the very beginning, the pre-filing period. You can think of this as the quiet period. The runners are on the track. They're stretching. You know, they're lacing up their shoes. But the starter pistol has not fired.
The paperwork is not filed.
Exactly. The paperwork's not been filed. And the core rule here is absolute and unforgiving. There can be no offers to sell and no offers to buy. Zero.
And this brings us to the famous gun jumping rule. And I want to pause here and actually ask the listener a direct question. So put yourself in Uma's shoes for a second. Let's say Frank goes on a highly popular tech podcast, you know, 3 weeks before Uma actually files the S-1 paperwork with the SEC.
Oh, boy.
Right. And Frank doesn't explicitly say the words, buy my stock. He doesn't say that. But he spends 30 minutes hyping up Frank's ferrets, talking about how their AI caller retention metrics are just through the roof and how they're going to monopolize the entire global pet tech economy.
Just completely hyping it.
Yeah. So, listener, take a second and think about this. What rule did Frank just break?
He committed a gun-jumping violation. Because in the eyes of the SEC, Frank just conditioned the market.
Okay, see, here is where my brain immediately goes wrong. Because I look at that and think, well, he didn't name a share price.
Right.
He didn't say the word stock. He just talked about his business. So how is that an offer?
Because the SEC's definition of an offer is incredibly broad during the pre-filing period. I mean, the entire philosophy of the 1933 Act is that investors should make financial decisions based on the cold, hard, heavily audited facts contained in a prospectus.
Not a podcast.
Exactly, not a podcast. If Frank goes on a show and whips the public into a speculative frenzy about his revolutionary AI, he is priming people to buy the stock before the regulatory disclosure even exists to balance out his hype. That is conditioning the market.
Wow. So the SEC essentially says, we aren't going to let you build up a massive wave of FOMO when the public doesn't even have the facts yet.
Exactly that. The regulators want a level playing field. If you let charismatic founders dictate the narrative before the paperwork is filed, the actual financial disclosures just become secondary. So gun jumping is strictly enforced.
Okay, so Uma drags Frank out of the podcast studio. She takes away his microphone, and she finally files the giant stack of paperwork with the SEC.
Right.
Bang! The starter pistol fires.
The race has begun.
We are now running down the track. This puts us in the second phase, known as the waiting period, or sometimes called the cooling off period.
Yeah, so the pistol has fired, meaning the SEC has the filing, but we have not crossed the finish line yet. The SEC hasn't declared the offering effective. During this period, the rules shift a bit. Oral offers are now completely fine.
Okay.
But actual sales, taking someone's money and executing a trade, those are strictly prohibited.
So you can talk about the race, but you cannot cross the finish line early.
Right.
So Frank can finally do his roadshow. He can stand in front of institutional investors like Buyer Bob and give his pitch. But what about written materials? Because I know the SEC is notoriously obsessed with what gets put down in writing.
They are, which is why written materials in the waiting period are highly restricted. You're basically allowed a few very specific things. First, you have the red herring, which is the preliminary prospectus. You also have tombstone announcements. And under certain strict conditions, you can use free writing prospectuses or FWPs.
Okay. Let's talk about the tombstone announcement, because this is a massive exam trap.
Huge.
A tombstone is supposed to be this incredibly bare bones, boring list of facts.
Right.
It's just the name of the issuer, the size of the offering, and the names of the syndicate banks.
Just the facts.
Just the facts. But let's say Frank, being a marketer at heart, decides to sneak a little slogan at the bottom of the tombstone. Just a tiny sentence that says, Frank's Ferrets, a great growth opportunity for savvy investors.
Oh, man. If he does that, Uma is going to need a paramedic, because a tombstone with selling commentary is no longer a tombstone. The moment Frank added promotional language, he stripped away the regulatory safe harbor. That document instantly transforms into an illegal written offer.
Because it stopped being a factual notice and became a marketing brochure.
Precisely. The SEC allows tombstones merely to signal to the market that a deal is happening and where to find the preliminary prospectus. It is a signpost, not a billboard.
A signpost. Not a billboard. That's a great way to remember it. Okay, so assuming Uma fixes Frank's tombstone disaster, the SEC finally finishes their review. They give the green light. We reach the finish line. This is the post-effective period.
Right. The SEC declares the registration statement effective. And at this exact moment, the race is over and sales are finally allowed. But there's a massive condition here.
What's that?
The final prospectus must be delivered to the buyers. You cannot take their money unless they have access to the final, finalized truth.
Okay, so Frank now understands the timeline. He knows when to shut up, when he can talk, and when he can finally cash the checks. But he looks at the literal palette of paperwork Uma just wheeled into his office. I mean, thousands of pages.
Mm.
And he asks the obvious question, what is actually in these documents?
And that brings us to the architecture of the disclosure itself. To pass the exam, you have to be able to distinguish between the two foundational SEC regulations that govern all this paperwork, Regulation SK and Regulation SX.
I actually rely on a very simple mnemonic for this. Let's look at them side by side. First, you have Regulation SK. I want you to think of SK as the story.
The story.
It is the narrative heart of a company. It contains the business overview, the risk factors, the executive compensation, and the management's discussion and analysis, the MDNA. So it's all the words explaining what Frank's ferrets does, how the AI caller works, and what keeps Frank up at night.
And balancing that out, you have regulation SX. Think of SX as the spreadsheets. This is the rigid quantitative side. It governs the audited financial statements, the balance sheets, the income statements. It also dictates the strict rules about the age of those financials and, you know, the pro forma statements if Frank decides to acquire a rival pet company.
So SK is the story, SX is the spreadsheets. But here is where it gets highly testable. So Frank is writing the SK narrative, right? And he wants to include a projection. He wants to state that based on current trends, his monthly active users, his MAUs, are going to 10x next year. Now, he knows that there is a safe harbor that protects forward-looking statements from lawsuits. So he figures he could just throw a massive number in there, slap a disclaimer on it, and be legally bulletproof.
It's a brilliant assumption, but it's a classic trap. The safe harbor for forward-looking statements does protect projections from civil liability, provided they are accompanied by meaningful cautionary language. But Regulation SK, the rule governing that narrative, demands that any projection included in the filing must have a reasonable basis.
Meaning he can't just pull a 10x multiplier out of thin air.
Exactly. The safe harbor protects a good faith estimate that turns out to be wrong, does not protect a completely fabricated fantasy. I mean, Frank needs a legitimate, factual, data-driven basis for claiming his user base will 10x. If his internal metrics show user growth is flatlining, and he projects a 10x increase just to juice the IPO valuation, that's not a protected forward-looking statement. That's fraud.
Wow. Yeah, that distinction is crucial. Now, let's talk about the physical forms this paperwork takes as we move through the foot race. We mentioned the red herring earlier. Why is it called a red herring, and what is it actually missing?
Historically, it was called a red herring because it had this disclaimer printed in bold red ink down the left side of the cover page, just warning investors that the information was preliminary and the SEC hadn't cleared it yet. As for what it's missing, it contains almost the entire SK story and the SX spreadsheets, except the final offering price.
Because they can't possibly know the price yet.
Right. During the waiting period, UMA is taking Frank on the roadshow. They're pitching buyer Bob and other institutional investors. They are building a book of indications of interest. They need that feedback to figure out what the market is actually willing to pay for this ferret technology. You can't print a final price until you know the demand.
Right, makes sense. So to finish the roadshow, the SEC declares them effective, and UMA's syndicate desk finally prices the deal at $20 a share. Now they have to file the final pricing supplement to fill in that blank. What is the deadline to get that final price filed with the SEC?
The rule is that the final pricing supplement must be filed within 2 business days of pricing or first use.
Okay, hold on. Let me create some friction here.
Yeah.
2 days makes total sense if you were just opening a PDF, typing $20 into a blank box, and hitting submit.
Yeah.
But what if something massive happens?
Like what?
Let's say during the roadshow, Frank's main manufacturing warehouse burns to the ground.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You can't just plug in a $20 price. You have to rewrite the entire risk factor section, update the MDNA, change the whole narrative.
Yeah.
Is that still a 2-day deadline?
It is not. And that logical friction is exactly how the exam tests you. The SEC understands the difference between a simple math update and a fundamental shift in the company's reality. If there are substantive changes to the prospectus, like a warehouse burning down, that triggers a different deadline. Substantive changes give the issuer 5 business days to file.
See, that is a perfect example of the SEC being pragmatic.
Mm.
2 days for a simple price insertion because the market needs to know the price immediately. 5 days for substantive changes because legal teams actually need time to draft new narrative disclosures.
Exactly. And there's one more timing rule regarding the prospectus that you absolutely must know. It's the 9-month, 16-month freshness rule. This applies heavily when a company uses a shelf registration.
Okay, a shelf registration is when a company registers a huge block of stock. But instead of selling it all at once, they put it on the shelf to sell in smaller chunks over a period of years, usually to time the market better.
Correct. But the SEC won't let you use a stale document to sell new shares. I mean, financial reality changes rapidly. If you leave a prospectus sitting on the shelf and you use it more than 9 months after its effective date, the financial statements inside that document cannot be more than 16 months old.
I think of it like checking the expiration date on a gallon of milk.
Right.
If the milk has been sitting in the fridge for too long, it was sour. If the financials are older than 16 months, the SEC considers them sour. You have to file fresh SX spreadsheets before you can take the stock off the shelf and sell it.
It forces continuous transparency. You just cannot raise capital today based on how your company was performing 2 years ago.
Right. So Frank is looking at this mountain of rules. He's looking at the SK narratives, the audited SX spreadsheets, the agonizing SEC review periods, the freshness tests. He starts doing the math on the legal fees, and he turns to Uma and asks the question every single founder asks. Isn't there a shortcut? Doesn't the government cut startups any slack?
And Uma gives him the good news. Yes, there are regulatory cheat codes. The rules actually adapt based on the size and maturity of the issuer.
Which brings us to the two major issuer classifications, emerging growth companies versus well-known seasoned issuers.
Let's start with EGCs.
Yeah, the startup cheat code. It was created by the JOBS Act to encourage smaller companies to go public.
Frank's ferrets almost certainly fits this. So what are the specific tripwires? How long does Frank get to keep this EGC status?
He's an EGC until he hits one of a few specific thresholds. The most heavily tested one is the revenue limit. Frank remains an EGC until his annual gross revenue hits $1.235 billion.
Okay, I'm going to pause and scream this from the rooftops for anyone studying right now. Wake up. If your textbook or flashcards say $1.07 billion, you are studying stale material. Yeah. Throw it out. The SEC indexes this number for inflation. The current testable threshold is $1.235 billion. Yes. It is a trap that catches a lot of test takers who rely on outdated PDFs. So revenue is the big one. But Frank can also lose EGC status if he issues $1 billion in non-convertible debt over a three-year period. Or if his public float grows so large, he becomes a large accelerated filer. Or simply, if 5 years pass since his IPO, once you hit the five-year anniversary, your startup phase is legally over.
But as long as he stays under those limits, why does Frank care? What does this cheat code actually save him?
Oh, it saves him massive amounts of time and money. For the SX spreadsheets, instead of needing 3 years of audited financials, an EGC only needs 2 years. But the real financial relief is that an EGC is exempt from the auditor attestation of internal controls under Sarbanes-Oxley 404B.
Let's translate that. Normally, a public company has to pay an expensive Big Four accounting firm, not just to audit their money, but to officially audit and grade the plumbing of their accounting department, how they approve expenses, how they log revenue. It costs a fortune.
Millions of dollars and thousands of man hours. The SEC realized this requirement was choking startups and preventing them from going public. So EGCs get a pass on the plumbing audit.
Wow. And there is a huge marketing benefit to being an EGC, too, regarding the pre-filing quiet period. The rule is called testing the waters.
Think back to the foot race. Normally, in the pre-filing period, no offers are allowed. Absolute silence. Gun jumping is strictly enforced. But as an EGC, Frank is allowed an exception. He can test the waters by talking to QIBs, qualified institutional buyers, and IAIs, institutional accredited investors, before Uma even files the S-1.
Why would he do that?
To gauge appetite. Yeah. IPOs are expensive. Frank wants to sit down with buyer Bob's hedge fund behind closed doors and say, look, we're thinking about going public. Here's our rough AI collar tech. Would you guys even be interested in buying this? If Bob says no, Frank saves himself millions in filing fees by aborting the process early.
But I'm going to ask the listener another question. Think about the logic of the SEC here. Can Frank use this testing the waters provision to call up retail investors? Like, can he solicit my grandmother to see if she wants to buy pre-IPO ferret stock?
Give them a second.
Yeah.
The answer is an absolute no. QIBs and IAIs only.
Because institutional buyers can fend for themselves.
That's the core philosophy. Hedge funds have armies of analysts. They don't need the SEC to hold their hand. But retail investors are highly susceptible to hype. They need the shield of a fully vetted, effective prospectus. If Frank pitches retail investors pre-filing, he loses the EGC protection and is instantly guilty of gun jumping.
EGCs also get to hide their homework, which is a massive strategic advantage.
Yes, the confidential submission. Normally, when you file an S-1, it is immediately public on the ADGR database. Your competitors can see your profit margins. The financial press can pick apart your risk factors. But EGCs are allowed to submit their draft registration statement to the SEC privately. The SEC reviews it, issues their brutal comments, Frank fixes the math, and the public never sees the messy early drafts.
But he can't stay hidden forever, right? There has to be a deadline before he starts taking money.
Right. The hard rule is that the EGC must file the registration statement publicly at least 15 days before they commence the roadshow.
15 days. And why 15? Because the market needs a minimum of 2 weeks to digest the SX spreadsheets before Uma starts actively taking orders on the roadshow.
Exactly.
Okay, so that is the startup cheat code. Let's flip to the other end of the spectrum, the boss level, the well-known seasoned issuer, or WKSI.
Yeah, a WKSI is a corporate leviathan. These are the Apples, the Microsofts, the massive pharmaceutical companies. To qualify as a WKSI, you have to meet one of two size thresholds. You need either a $700 million public float, which means $700 million public float, which means $700 million of equity held by non-affiliates out in the open market, or you must have issued $1 billion in non-convertible debt in the last 3 years.
I want to hammer on the logic of those thresholds. Notice it is an OR test, not an AND test. You don't need both. Why? Because the SEC is looking for proof that the market pays deep attention to you. A high-growth tech company might easily have a $700 million float, proving Wall Street analysts are watching their every move. But what about a massive privately held utility company that builds power plants?
An example.
They might not have public equity, but if they're issuing $1 billion in bonds to institutional debt buyers, the credit markets are scrutinizing their balance sheet constantly. Both paths prove that the company is highly seasoned.
The logic is flawless. Because these companies are so heavily scrutinized by thousands of analysts every single day, the SEC treats them differently. They get the ultimate cheat code, which is the automatic shelf registration, filed on form S3 ASR.
Break down automatic. Like, how fast is that?
It is instantaneous. It goes effective immediately upon filing. There is zero SEC review. There is no waiting period. A WKSI can decide on a Tuesday night that they want to raise $2 billion, file the S3 ASR on Wednesday morning, and sell the stock on Wednesday afternoon.
It's just breathtaking speed.
Mm-hmm.
And WKSIs also get a total pass on the bin jumping rules, right?
They do. They can use free writing prospectuses even in the pre-filing period. They can communicate whatever they want, whenever they want.
Wow.
The SEC trusts WKSIs because they operate as a living prospectus. They're already filing 10Ks and 10Qs. The market already knows their deep financials. So the SEC steps out of the way to let capital flow efficiently.
Okay, so Uma has guided Frank through the 1933 Act periods. She figured out the SK and SX paperwork. She utilized the EGC cheat code to save him money. But just when they think they are in the clear, another regulator steps into the room.
FINRA.
Because while the SEC cares about disclosure, FINRA cares about fairness. FINRA is watching to make sure Uma's investment bank isn't using its power to rip off Frank's ferrets or the investing public.
This falls under the FINRA corporate financing rule. Its entire purpose is to govern how underwriters get compensated.
And what is the mechanism FINRA uses to judge that?
The core standard is that underwriting compensation cannot be unfair or unreasonable. FINRA evaluates every single deal on a case-by-case basis, looking at the totality of the circumstances.
Here is where my brain immediately goes to a rigid metric. I assume FINRA, being a strict regulator, would just publish a spreadsheet. You know, if the deal is this size, the maximum fee is 8%. But they don't do that, do they?
They intentionally do not set a hard cap.
Okay, listener, wake up. Put down your coffee. Write this down in giant letters. If you see an exam question asking for the maximum allowable underwriting compensation and one of the answers is a fixed percentage, like 9% or 8%, it is a trap. Do not click it. Why doesn't FINRA just use a fixed number?
Because the economics of underwriting vary wildly based on scale and risk. Underwriting a $10 million microcap IPO for a risky biotech startup requires a massive amount of due diligence and sales effort relative to the capital raised. A 9% fee there might be perfectly reasonable.
Right.
But if you are underwriting a $5 billion follow-on offering for a massive WKSI, a 9% fee would be an outrageous windfall for the bank. FINRA needs the flexibility to look at the specific risk and scale of each deal to determine what is fair.
That makes sense. FINRA is also hyper aware of how banks might try to game the system.
Well,
what if Frank is cash poor, so he pays Uma's bank with huge blocks of pre-IPO stock instead of cash? FINRA wants to make sure Uma's bank doesn't take that stock, hype up the IPO, and then instantly dump their shares on retail investors on opening day to cash out.
To prevent that exact scenario, FINRA imposes a 180-day lockup on any shares the underwriter receives as compensation. The bank cannot sell, transfer, or hedge those shares for 6 months.
Let's test the timeline logic here. When does that 180-day clock start? My instinct says it starts on the effective date, when the SEC declares the race over.
And that is a very common mistake. The 180-day lockup starts from the commencement of sales.
Why the difference?
Because effectiveness is just a regulatory stamp on a piece of paper. The actual market risk, the moment the public starts trading and retail investors are exposed to price volatility, begins when sales commence. FINRA ties the lockup to the moment the bank would theoretically be able to dump the shares into the live market.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Now let's talk about the deepest FINRA scrutiny, which is conflicts of interest. What if Uma's investment bank isn't just an independent advisor? What if her bank already owns a massive equity stake in Frank's Ferrets from an early venture round? Or what if the bank is taking a huge cut of the IPO money to pay off a loan the bank made to Frank last year?
Finera has stretched tripwires for conflicts of interest. A highly testable one is the proceeds trigger. If the underwriter is receiving 5% or more of the net offering proceeds, meaning 5% of the actual capital being raised is going straight into the bank's pocket beyond the standard underwriting fee, Finera flags that as a severe conflict of interest.
Because if Uma's bank is getting that much of the pie, Uma is heavily incentivized to price the IPO as high as possible to benefit her own firm, regardless of whether it's fair price for the public. So when they hit that 5% trigger, does the deal just die?
No, the deal can proceed, but Finera requires a structural fix. They must bring in a QIU, a qualified independent underwriter.
This is a fascinating mechanism. The QIU is an outside, neutral investment bank. They step in the deal to review the pricing, audit the disclosure, and ensure Uma isn't fleecing the public. But Finera doesn't let just any bank be a QIU. They require a specific track record.
The QIU must have served as a manager or co-manager in at least 3 similar public offerings of similar size and scope during the preceding 3 years.
Why 3 in 3 years?
To guarantee recent relevant experience, FineRO doesn't want a bank that hasn't done an IPO since the dot-com bubble stepping in to evaluate a modern AI tech deal. They need to know the current market intimately.
But here is the real kicker. The QIU isn't just a consultant writing a report for a flat fee. I want you, the listener, to think about the risk dynamic here. When that outside bank agrees to act as the QIU and signs off on the pricing, what are they actually risking?
Give it a beat.
Yeah, think about it.
They are risking their entire firm.
Wow.
The QIU takes on full, strict underwriter liability. If Frank's registration statement turns out to be fraudulent, the QIU can be sued right alongside Uma's firm. That massive threat of liability is the only way Finera can ensure the QIU actually does rigorous adversarial due diligence rather than just rubber stamping the deal as a favor to another bank.
And speaking of that massive threat of liability, that perfectly transitions us into the dark side of securities law. Civil liability.
This scary stuff.
Very. Because what happens if Frank lies? Let's say Frank's SK narrative states that his app has 5 million monthly active users. But in reality, his internal dashboard shows he only had 50,000 users, and he intentionally faked the data to secure a $1 billion valuation. The IPO happens, the stock plummets when the truth comes out, and the lawsuits begin.
Welcome to Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933. This governs civil liability for a false registration statement.
The best way to visualize Section 11 liability is not as a list of rules, but as a bomb going off.
I like that.
Yeah, the false registration statement is the bomb. When it detonates, it creates a blast radius. The closer you are to the center of the explosion, the less chance you have of surviving the lawsuits.
That's a brilliant way to frame the standard of defense. Let's look at ground zero.
Ground zero is the issuer. Frank, the founder, and Frank's Ferrets is a corporate entity. The issuer faces strict liability. If the registration statement was materially false at the moment of effectiveness, the issuer loses the lawsuit, period.
But what about the first ring outside of ground zero? This includes underwriter Uma, the board of directors, and the experts, like the auditors who signed off on the SX spreadsheets. They are caught in the blast, but they have a mechanism to survive.
They can build a bunker. In legal terms, this is called the due diligence defense.
Right. If Uma can prove in federal court that she conducted a reasonable investigation and had reasonable grounds to believe Frank's user metrics were real, you know, maybe she hired independent forensic data analysts, reviewed server logs, really did the hard work, she can escape liability.
She gets to live.
She gets to live. The SEC wants to incentivize underwriters to relentlessly check the issuer's math. The due diligence defense is the reward for doing that job well.
But this sets up the ultimate exam trap. Let's twist the scenario. What if Frank didn't fake the numbers? What if Frank's lead engineer hacked the dashboard and tricked Frank? Frank genuinely believed they had 5 million users. He did his own reasonable investigation and was just as surprised as everyone else when it blew up. Does Frank, as the CEO of the issuer, get to use the due diligence defense?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. The issuer has no due diligence defense. None. Zero. The company is strictly liable for its own registration statement, no matter how hard they tried to get it right. Why? Because it is their company. The SEC will not allow a corporation to raise capital on false pretenses and then say, oops, we didn't know our own data was fake.
The blast at ground zero is inescapable.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is Section 11 liability for the registration statement itself. But what if the lie isn't in the official filing? What if Frank lies during the roadshow presentation or in like a marketing pamphlet?
Then we move to Section 12, which governs prospectus and communications liability. This covers material misstatements made in oral communications or written sales materials. The core mechanical difference here is privity.
Privity means the plaintiff actually had to buy the security directly from the descendant. Buyer Bob can't just sue anyone. He has to sue the exact entity that sold him the shares based on that oral lie. And the defense here is called reasonable care, which functions similarly to due diligence, but is slightly less rigorous because the context is often oral, fast-moving sales environments.
And finally, encompassing everything, we have the catch-all. The SEC's ultimate weapon, Section 10B of the Exchange Act, and Rule 10B5, the general anti-fraud provision.
The anti-fraud provision is so broad it reaches mere negligence. You don't even have to execute an intentional masterminded scam to violate it. Just being recklessly sloppy with the truth can trigger a federal lawsuit.
And it applies to everything.
Let me create a scenario to test that. Let's say Frank's Ferrets looks at all this Section 11 liability, looks at the SX audit costs, and Frank says, you know what, forget the IPO, it's too risky, I'm gonna do a private placement, I'll rely on a Regulation D exemption, sell only to billionaires, and totally bypass the 1933 Act registration rules.
Okay.
Since he is officially exempt from registering the offering, does that mean he is immune from the anti-fraud provision?
It is the exact opposite. You can never, ever hide from anti-fraud. The general anti-fraud provision applies to all securities offerings, period. Whether it is a massively registered public IPO, a quiet exempt private placement, or selling shares out of the trunk of your car, if you are selling a security and you commit fraud, Rule 10b-5 applies.
There's no exemption for lying. Beautifully clear. So Frank realizes he can't escape. He runs a clean, honest IPO. No fake users. Just a solid tech company. The IPO prices, the stock lists on the NASDAQ, and Frank's Ferrets is officially a public company.
Which means Frank is now a public company CEO, and that means a whole new set of ongoing regulatory behavioral rules click into place.
Which brings us to Regulation FD, which stands for Fair Disclosure. Let's paint a picture. Frank's company has been public for 6 months. He is at the Rosewood Hotel Bar on Sand Hill Road. He's having drinks with buyer Bob, our fleece-wearing hedge fund manager.
Bob's favorite spot.
Naturally. Bob buys Frank two extra dry martinis, pretends to be his best friend, and gets Frank talking. Frank accidentally blurts out that a major retailer is dropping their product and their upcoming quarterly earnings are going to be absolutely terrible.
Frank just triggered a massive Reg FD violation.
Selective disclosure.
Right. The core mechanism of Reg FD is designed to prevent a two-tiered market. A public company cannot selectively leak material non-public information, MNPI, to market professionals, analysts, or to shareholders who are likely to trade on it.
Like Bob. Bob is going to walk out of that bar, short the stock, and make millions before the public even knows the retailer dropped the product.
Exactly. The SEC demands fair disclosure. If you are going to release material info, you have to release it to the entire public at the exact same time.
So Frank wakes up the next morning, realizes what he said to Bob, and panics. He calls Uma's legal team. What are the rules for curing this leak? I know the timeline splits depending on Frank's state of mind when he leaked it.
It does. It splits into intentional versus non-intentional leaks. If the disclosure was intentional, meaning Frank purposefully pulled Bob aside to give him a tip or was incredibly reckless, the company must cure the violation by disclosing that same information to the public simultaneously.
Which is physically impossible if you were already at a bar. But Frank's leak was an accident. He just had too many martinis. It was a non-intentional selective disclosure.
For non-intentional leaks, the SEC provides a slightly wider window. The company must cure it by filing a Form 8K.
Just to define that briefly for the listener, an 8K is the SEC form used to announce major unscheduled material events to the market. It is the emergency broadcast system of corporate disclosure.
Perfect definition. And for a non-intentional leak, the company must file that 8K promptly.
Okay, here's your interactive question. And this is a scenario that shows up constantly. Frank leaks the terrible earnings info by accident to Bob on a Friday night at 8:00 p.m. Mm-hmm. When is Frank's absolute deadline to file that Form 8K to cure the non-intentional leak? Take a second to figure out the timeline.
Let's do the math.
Okay, you got it.
The rule defines promptly as within 24 hours OR before the start of the next normal trading session on the New York Stock Exchange, whichever is later.
Whichever is later. Yeah. Think about the logic here. 24 hours from Friday at 8:00 p.m. is Saturday at 8:00 p.m. But the next NYSE Open isn't until Monday morning at 9:30 a.m. Monday morning is later than Saturday night. So Frank has until Monday morning before the bell to file that 8K.
Why does the SEC give him until Monday? Because the market is closed over the weekend. Even if Bob has the inside information, he can't execute a trade on the exchange to exploit it. There's no active harm occurring while the market is closed. So the SEC gives the legal team the weekend to draft the 8K, as long as it hits the wire before the opening bell on Monday.
That whichever is later clause is brilliant, but it is a classic exam trick. Don't let them trick you into picking a Saturday deadline. Okay, so while Frank is dealing with his 8K hangover, Uma's investment bank is gearing up to do a follow-on offering for Frank's company. Yeah, Frank needs more cash, so they are going to underwrite and sell more stock to the public. But at the exact same time, Uma's research department, the analysts who sit on a different floor of the bank, they want to publish a highly favorable research report on Frank's company.
This creates a massive regulatory collision. We already established that during the waiting period of a new offering, written marketing materials are severely restricted. The SEC asks a very logical question. Is a glowing research report published by the underwriter's own bank essentially an illegal written offer to sell the new stock?
If the syndicate desk is trying to sell the stock, and the research desk is blasting out a report saying the stock is a strong buy, that looks a lot like a coordinated illegal free-writing prospectus. But research analysts have a job to do. They can't just take a vow of silence on a major tech company every time their bank's syndicate desk wins an underwriting mandate.
Which is why the SEC created the research safe harbors. These rules maintain the information barrier between the bankers and the analysts, allowing research to continue without violating the 1933 Act. On the exam, you have to look at whether the broker-dealer publishing the research is participating in the underwriting syndicate.
In this case, Uma's firm is the lead underwriter. They are actively participating in selling the new stock.
Because they are participating, they face the tightest restrictions. They cannot just randomly initiate coverage on Frank's ferrets out of nowhere to subtly hype up Uma's deal. To be protected by the safe harbor, they must rely on the regularly published standard. Meaning, if they want to write a report about Frank's equity stock while Uma is underwriting Frank's equity stock, the bank must have a documented history of regularly publishing research on Frank's company in the ordinary course of business.
What if they don't have that history? What if this is the first time the bank has ever looked at PebTech? Are they totally blocked from publishing anything?
They might be able to use a different mechanism. The other class, safe harbor. Let's say Uma is underwriting a debt offering for Frank. She is selling his corporate bonds. Her research analyst is allowed to publish a report initiating coverage on Frank's equity, the stock, as long as it is a completely different class of security than what is being underwritten, and the firm regularly publishes research on that general type of asset.
That makes sense. The same class requires a regular publishing history for that specific company. A different class just requires a history of publishing in that asset type. The entire goal is to keep the supposedly objective research desk from turning into a hype machine for the syndicate desk's current deal.
It forces Wall Street to maintain functional independence.
Okay, we are rounding the final corner. We have spent this entire time talking about the mechanics of the Securities Act of 1933. But Frank's IPO is done. He is now living in the aftermarket. He is operating a public company day to day. This brings in the other half of the regulatory regime, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
It is vital to keep the two acts distinct in your mind.
I have a metaphor for this that clears it up instantly. Think of the 1933 Act as the birth certificate for the specific shares being sold. It registers the creation and the initial sale of that specific block of stock. The 1934 Act, on the other hand, registers the company itself. It is the passport for the company's ongoing life in the public secondary markets. It governs the continuous disclosures, the annual 10-Ks, the quarterly 10-Qs, the emergency 8-Ks we just talked about.
Birth certificate for the shares, passport for the company. I like that. So how does a company actually get that 1934 Act passport and become a reporting company?
There are two main paths. If Frank's Ferrets does a traditional IPO and lists on a national exchange like the NYSE or the NASDAQ, he gets the express lane. The company files a short form 8A, and they become registered under the 34 Act concurrently with their IPO. The exchange listing effectively triggers the passport.
But not every company lists on an exchange. What if Frank's Ferrets never did an IPO? What if they just stayed private, issued stock to employees, raised private venture capital, and grew into a massive corporation with shares trading on the opaque over-the-counter markets?
Then they hit the residual lane, which is known as the asset and holder path. The SEC essentially says, you are too big to hide in the shadows anymore. You have to get your passport. A company is forced to register under the 34 Act if they reach 2,000 shareholders of record or 500 non-accredited retail shareholders, and they have more than $10 million in total assets.
Once you hit those size metrics, the SEC forces you into the light, requiring you to file the continuous 10-Ks and 10-Qs so the public market can see your financials.
Okay, the final major mechanical concept we need to cover is prospectus delivery duties in the aftermarket. The IPO is done. UMA has sold the initial shares. Now, those shares are trading freely on the NASDAQ between regular retail investors. Does a broker-dealer executing a secondary market trade literally have to mail a physical paper prospectus to every single person who buys the stock?
In the modern internet-connected era, the SEC adopted a pragmatic rule called access equals delivery. Because the final prospectus is uploaded and permanently available on the SEC's public EDR database, the SEC decided that electronic access is legally equivalent to physical delivery. When the document is filed online, the delivery requirement is satisfied.
Which saves millions of trees and millions of dollars in postage. But wait, here comes the exam trap. Does the access equals delivery rule apply to the preliminary prospectus for an IPO?
It absolutely does not. And this is a critical distinction. For a first-time, previously non-reporting issuer, a true IPO, the broker must physically or electronically push the preliminary prospectus directly to the buyer at least 48 hours before confirming the sale.
This is the 48-hour rule. But why? If access equals delivery is so efficient for the final prospectus, why not use it for the preliminary one too?
Think about the psychology of a retail investor. A first-time issuer is a brand new story to the market. There is massive hype, massive FOMO. The SEC wants to guarantee a psychological cooling off period. By forcing the broker to push that document into the investor's hands 48 hours before the trade is locked, they're ensuring the retail investor actually has a window to read the risk factors before their money is legally committed. EDR is great, but a new retail investor needs the risks put directly in front of their face.
That makes perfect sense. So after the IPO, how long does this delivery duty last for secondary market dealers? Like, how long is the delivery clock ticking?
The length of the dealer delivery clock depends entirely on the transparency of the market the stock is trading in. If it is an exchange-listed IPO, like on the NASDAQ, the clock is 25 days.
Why only 25 days?
Because national exchanges have their own massive transparency and reporting requirements, the market digests the information quickly. But if it is an over-the-counter IPO, a much more opaque, less regulated market, the clock stretches to 90 days. The SEC demands a longer period of forced disclosure because OTC companies are inherently riskier and less scrutinized.
And what if the company is already a reporting company, like Microsoft issuing more stock? What is their delivery clock?
0 days. No aftermarket dealer delivery is required because Microsoft already has its 34 Act passport. The market already has years of 10Ks and 10Qs to rely on.
Phew. Okay, we've successfully mapped the jungle. To lock this in for the exam, let's do a rapid-fire recap of the five most heavily testable gotchas we cover today, ping-pong style. You ready?
Let's do it.
Number one, the emerging growth company revenue limit.
$1.235 billion. It is indexed for inflation. Do not pick $1.07 billion.
Number two, civil liability under Section 11 for a false registration statement.
The issuer has no due diligence defense. They are strictly liable. Only the underwriters and experts get the bunker defense.
Number three, Regulation FD non-intentional leak timing.
You must cure it promptly, which mechanically means the later of 24 hours or the start of the next normal trading session on the NYSE.
Number four, the Finagri Qualified Independent Underwriter.
A QIU needs a track record of three similar deals in the past 3 years, and crucially, they take on full, strict underwriter liability to ensure they do their job.
And number five, Finagri's rule on underwriting compensation limits.
There is no fixed percentage. 9% is a trap. The standard is entirely case by case, based on what is unfair or unreasonable.
Boom, you are going to crush this exam.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave the listener with a final thought to mull over. When you step back and look at this massive web of SEC and Finagri regulations, look at how perfectly these rules balance market speed against the protection of the retail investor. Take the WKSI auto shelf registration. The government allows billions of dollars to move literally overnight, based entirely on the premise that a company is so widely followed by analysts, the market itself has become a living prospectus. But on the flip side, when a company stops filing its 34 Act reports and goes dark, the SEC can freeze trading entirely. The whole system, the speed of the cheat codes, the massive threat of civil liability, the 48-hour cooling off periods, it all relies entirely on one thing, the continuous flow of truth.
The continuous flow of truth. I love that. So the next time you are stuck in the muddy waters of a Series 79 practice question, just remember the foot race, remember Frank faking his user metrics, and remember that every single obscure rule is just a mechanical tool designed to protect that flow of truth. You've got this. Good luck on the exam, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.